This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we speak with an SR-71 crew member, instructor pilot, wing commander, airline pilot, and author. In the news, we look at the Airbus helicopters H-160, an F-35 report from the Government Accountability Office, the grounding of the B-1B fleet, and new airports for Thailand. Also, North American flyers are happier, 5 must-see TV programs about airplanes, the Texas Aircraft Expo, where 12-year-old Claire impressed us, and listener feedback. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 507 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is our associate producer, Brian Coleman.
Hi, Max. Looking forward to a really good show tonight. We have, I think, a very special guest, and I've tried so hard to get certain people on the show for David, and David's finally here, so I'm super excited about this.
I know. We have a sort of a track record here of getting someone on that David could relate to, and then he takes the day off. But he's not taking the week off this time, and so we're pleased to have with us David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. Hi, David.
Hi. I'll be happy to leave if that'll make you feel better, Brian.
No. Absolutely wanted you.
I mean, I would be perfectly happy being on the couch sleeping right now, but no, I'm looking forward to tonight. It's an interesting aircraft we're going to be talking about and a very interesting career, it sounds like. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great. Our other co-host, Max Trescott, is off. He has a paying customer, a student pilot. I guess they're working on a check ride or something. So unfortunately, Max Trescott won't be joining us this episode. But let me introduce our guest. Our guest is Colonel Richard Graham. He entered the SR-71 Strategic Reconnaissance Program in 1974. After several years as a crew member, he became an instructor pilot in the SR-71. And in 1978, he was selected as the Chief Standardization Evaluation Division. And in 1980, he was the SR-71 Squadron Commander for the 1st Strategic Reconnaissance Squadron. Following 4 years in the Pentagon, Rich was selected to be the 9th Strategic Reconnaissance Wing Commander at Beale Air Force Base. That was in June 1987. He's written 5 books on the SR-71. Prior to the SR-71 program, he flew 210 combat missions in Vietnam. I was in the F-4 C&D Phantom as well as the Wild Weasel. Rich was a command pilot with more than 4,600 military flying hours. He has a lot of military decorations, amazing. 3 Legion of Merit Awards, 4 Distinguished Flying Cross Medals, and 19 Air Medals. Well, after serving 25 years in the Air Force, Colonel Graham flew for American Airlines for 13 years, accumulating over 8,000 flying hours. He was hired at American as a flight engineer, flying the Boeing 727 and the DC-10. But after 2 years, he moved to the right seat of the MD-80. And his last 3 years saw Rich as captain on the MD-80. Now, Rich, I think if you add all that up, you have, I guess, over 16,000 flying hours. Is that accurate?
That's as close as I round them off to. I'm at the point where I round them off the nearest 100.
That's amazing. And today you can find Rich flying and teaching at McKinney, Texas Airport for the Texans Flying Club. So, Rich, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Good. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Now, we've had episodes in the past with guests that have had experience with the SR-71, but it's an aircraft that just keeps coming back. You can't get enough of the Blackbird. Rich, what do you think it is that seems to capture our interest like no other aircraft?
Probably most aviators or aviation enthusiasts think about the SR as far as obviously being the world's fastest airplane. And when you think about the time and the frame, which Kelly Johnson built this airplane, it was a fantastic airplane for that day and age. And I think that's what attracts most people. They just can't believe it was done in that quick of time and that time frame.
Yes, one of the things I think we'll be talking about coming up is would it even be possible to develop something like that these days? It doesn't seem likely, but we'll talk with Rich about that. First, though, we've got some news from the past week to talk about. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready.
Our first story comes from Wired.com. This is Airbus H-160 helicopter helps save pilots from their own mistakes. Max Trescott put this story in the lineup here before he realized he wasn't going to make it, but it's quite a story. The Airbus helicopter's H-160 is a medium-duty helicopter. It's the first of their H generation. And Airbus says, quote, "The entire design was based on one overriding goal: to create added value for customers in terms of performance, economic competitiveness, safety, and comfort." Well, this H-160, it features an advanced, they call it automatic recovery mode, and it's designed to help pilots in difficult situations. I guess in a sense, if you find yourself in hot water, the helicopter is able to right itself, I guess, and bring it back under control. Rich, in the military context, do we ever see aircraft that have any kind of features like that, or is it always just up to the pilot?
I personally have not seen anything like that or even discussed about. Now, there are some airplanes that will do, they can make themselves come upright and stuff like that, but I've never heard to that extent to be able to sort of take over and make everything happy camper. I don't know. It's all new to me.
This newfangled technology. I guess Airbus has had a type of recovery mode in the past, but I think with this helicopter, they've sort of upped the game a bit. It's more capable. It's a good size helicopter. It can seat 12 passengers, fly up to 530 miles on a full tank, top speed of 177 miles per hour. Now, it uses two turboshaft engines for power, Turbomeca Arano turboshaft engines. They're in the sort of around 1,200 shaft horsepower range each. One of the features of these engines is that they offer 15% less fuel consumption, very advantageous. The other thing about this helicopter is that the tail rotor is angled 10 degrees toward the ground. So we all know what the tail rotor does. Principally counters the helicopter's tendency to rotate beneath the main rotor. But with this 10-degree angle, it actually provides some forward thrust as well, according to Airbus. So interesting.
I like the fact it has an auto-hover function, and it's designed for whiteout and brownout. It will help the pilot descend and land or hover in less invisible abilities.
Conditions, yeah.
Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. Challenges.
And David, you might know this. There's one picture that's further down in the article that shows the main rotor blade, and it looks like there's a bit of an angle on it. I'm not sure if that's tilted up or tilted back. Have you seen any other helicopters with the main rotor in that shape?
Besides Apaches, UH-60s, most modern helicopters.
Okay, so a lot is what you're saying. Okay, fair enough.
What it does is by the scimitar shape, it makes it easier to cut because, remember, the tips are going supersonic. So that cranked rotor blades are more efficient than straight rotor blades. They're always cranked into the direction they're flying to facilitate lift and drag, and you're not getting the sonic booms which you would get from a normal helicopter, like the whoop, 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 whoop of a UH-1.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, tip speed is an important thing, I think.
In helicopters, absolutely.
Yeah.
So if you look at most modern helicopters, they have a cranked rotor blades. Hmm. Some of them are smaller than others. This is pretty dramatic, but as they've moved forward, they actually have had cranked rotor blades for a long time.
Okay.
All right, well, let's talk about the F-35. This is from the Motley Fool, 966 open deficiencies. Now, apparently about 20% of those are expected to remain open when the Pentagon is scheduled to begin full-rate production. If you're not aware of that, we have not entered into what they call full-rate production yet with the F-35. So the GAO is advising the Pentagon to hold off until all these issues are addressed before they go into full-rate production. I guess, David, from what I can tell from this article, the Pentagon is sort of responding positively to that recommendation from the GAO.
Well, yeah, it's ironic that we're talking about this as the 300th or the Air Force's 150th aircraft crossed the line. This is a long, low-rate production run. Yes, there's a lot of problems with the aircraft, but delaying them, we wouldn't have done this back when we created the SR-71. We'd figure it out and move on. Unfortunately, if you read the article from the GAO, the problems that are out there are the Air Force in particular wanting the bleeding edge technology to work before they get the airplane. And sometimes that technology needs to mature a little bit before they throw it in the airplane. And in this case, they want to wait for the technology to mature before they deploy it in the airplane. So it can't be too bad of an aircraft because the Israelis have already used it in combat. And they weren't waiting around for the production ones. They took low-rate production aircraft and have now deployed them in combat. Yes, the GAO wants them to hold back and delay receiving them and signing off on them, but I don't really see the gain there. I mean, what for another year from now, they're going to say, well, we found another X amount because the Air Force has changed the specifications again. So it's kind of a difficult thing we have now that we've got three aircraft on one production line, and they want to delay things, which means it's a delay across the board. The Government Accounting Office is asking for delays on all of the aircraft, so that would delay all of the Air Force aircraft, all of the Norwegian aircraft, all of the Israeli aircraft, all of the Japanese aircraft, all of the Italian aircraft, all of the Norwegian aircraft, and the Navy and the Marine Corps. And the Brits. So one wonders what, you know, putting America first because we don't have the bleeding edge technology is a little kind of ridiculous in all of this at this point. We really need to start moving into production and they'll fix it.
I was just wondering from Rich's standpoint, when the SR-71 first came out, if there were or how many defects there were or deficiencies and if there was any holdup of the aircraft or if they just pushed forward and or because it was such a, I'd say, simpler aircraft and it certainly wasn't simple for the times. How was the aircraft?
Well, obviously it wasn't as high tech as the F-35 that you've been talking about, but you have to remember, when you talk about the SR-71, that's the predecessor of two other airplanes before it, the A-12, which was flown by the CIA, and then the YF-12, which was supposed to be an interceptor. So there was a lot of concurrency going on at the Skunk Works, starting out with the A-12 and then the YF-12 and the SR-71. So, you know, the 71 was not the very first platform of the Blackbirds.
So it had a little bit of history preceding it.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Well, the production rate on the F-35 is significant in terms of dollars. I think I get that the production rate would be about 100 F-35s a year, and with a list price, at least according to this article, of about $80 million per plane. You know, do the math, and there's a lot of money involved in here. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was some statistics that I had not seen before. I'm aware that when you begin a program like this, the unit cost is high, and then over time, the manufacturing cost decreases for a variety of reasons. But just to illustrate what's happened with the F-35, we see that the average number of hours of labor to manufacture an F-35 in 2012 was 108,355. 108,000 labor hours to manufacture, on average, one F-35. But now it's 41,541 hours. That's 38% by my math, which is a huge decrease. The other statistic here is average total hours spent on scrap, rework, and repair per aircraft. That's another manufacturing sort of metric that's fairly common. So the average total hours spent on scrap, rework, and repair per aircraft in 2012 was 20,125, and now it's 6,237. So there again, a big drop. So that's entirely typical of a program like this, where the numbers are big at the beginning and then go down over time. The manufacturing becomes more efficient. The processes are developed. So it's sort of telling. I don't know how much more efficiency is in the F-35, if we'll see those numbers continue to drop. I doubt they'd go down as much as they have already, but it's been pretty significant.
Well, keep in mind that there was a complete rework of the F-35B somewhere in that initial, where it was way too heavy and wasn't able to do what it was supposed to do, which is vertical takeoff and landing. So at one point, Lockheed basically went back to the drawing board and figured out how many olives they could take out of the airframe so that it would be cost efficient and take off in the amount of time, so, and the amount of length of runway. So this is one of those, no matter what, someone is going to look at this and say, it's bad news, cancel the project. And if we go back in time and look at things like FRED, which was the C-5, which was the environmental disaster, as they'd like to call it, or say the Phantom or the F-104.
Or the tanker?
Well,
the tanker had different problems. Okay.
Well, if you go back and look at the F-104, this is a serious problem when one out of every three was being flown into the ground and killing the pilots. Mm. You know, and it took Germany. Germany was flying them into the ground left and right and killing pilots left and right, calling a widowmaker. Same thing with a lot of Navy aircraft in the 50s and 60s. So we have an aircraft that has little to no incidents for all intents and purposes now that it's live whereas it's expensive, but it's saving pilots. How much is a pilot? What's the cost of a pilot worth? You know, when you talk about, we talk about billions of dollars, but when you talk about training like the colonel here, all of the years that we've paid to school him and train him and the various aircraft in the schools and the amount of money we put into him as a pilot and as an educator, et cetera. And to lose that loss of life is a pretty economical, if you want to be cruel about it, pretty economical thing that you're losing lots of money and lots of value that you've invested. So, yes, okay, there are millions of dollars of airplanes, but we still shouldn't learn from the lesson of the B-2 bomber, where we built 25 of them when we were going. We ordered originally 100, and everybody wondered why they were so damn expensive.
Yeah. Rich, when you were flying the SR-71, did you feel like you were at risk, that it was a dangerous thing?
You got to break that down in two different terms. Are you talking about the enemy or the airplane itself?
Yeah, let's start with the airplane itself.
The airplane is very reliable. You have to remember that all the 50 of the Blackbirds, and that includes the A-12, the YF-12, and the SR-71, 50 were built. And during that whole time frame, over 25 years, we've lost 19 blackbirds of all varieties. And of that 19, 18 of them were lost in the first 6 years. So it had a very steep learning curve, the test pilots and everyone else. So when it became operational with the Air Force, it was a fairly safe airplane and a very reliable airplane in that regard.
All right. Well, yeah, another airplane that seems to be having an issue lately is the B-1 bomber. And we have an article from Business Insider. This is Air Force Global Strike Command has ordered its B-1 bombers to stand down after finding, quote, an issue with ejection seat components. Now, I'm a little confused. There's also an article in The Drive. The Air Force has grounded all of its B-1Bs over a fault in their ejection seats. So I guess the entire fleet of B-1B bombers is grounded. It has something to do with ejection seats, but we don't know exactly what, I guess. But do we know? Now, this follows from the safety investigation after an emergency landing of a B-1B at Midland International Air and Spaceport in Midland, Texas. And that was last May 1st. Yeah, what's going on here?
Okay. The aircraft took off from Dyess Air Force Base. The aircraft's name was Spectre. In fact, I've actually seen her on various air shows. At altitude, the B-1 has got a swing wing. They had an engine fire that was effectively into the wing. The pilot in command decided that they were going to implement an ejection. Now, there's two different types of injections. There's a manual ejection, and then there's a automatic injection. The automatic ejection means that the pilot pulls the lever and everybody goes out in order. So, and they all leave the aircraft. A manual ejection means that each crewman, which is a pilot, a co-pilot, a defensive weapon systems operator, and an offensive weapon systems operator, will go out separately. And it was very clear that the aircraft was unstable and the engine fire wasn't going to be put out. And the pilot in command ordered a manual ejection. Well, the first person was the offensive weapon systems operator, which I believe is the crewman directly behind the co-pilot. He pulled the lever, initiated the ACES ejection process. The roof popped and left the aircraft, but the seat didn't go.
Ooh, that's not good.
So what you had then was you had a crewman that was sitting on a live ejection seat that didn't fire, and if everybody else punched out, he was going to go down with the aircraft. The pilot in command decided, okay, well, that's not going to work. So they did an emergency landing and brought her in, the aircraft, into Midland Airport and Spaceport. But this caused a stand down for all of the ejection seats, because the one thing you don't want is someone to try to eject out of an aircraft and not go. The B-1 has the ACES 2 ejection seat. B-1 ejection seats are, while the ACES is in a lot of aircraft, like the F-117, the F-16, the F-15, the B-1's kind of different because of the long-range mission of it. So the ACES ejection seats are specifically to the B-1. Therefore, they grounded the B-1. It must have been a fairly drastic issue, because we have forward-based B-1s overseas that are fighting in the Middle East and in Asia, and they grounded the whole fleet. So I have a feeling that they'll work out this and pull all the seats, double-check them, and then recert them in the aircraft, and they'll start gradually coming back to flight. But it is a pretty serious thing to have a pilot needing to eject out of an aircraft and the seat failed.
And Rich, I'm just wondering, I don't know if you've ever ejected or not, but I've heard that it's a relatively violent undertaking. I just wonder, the person that did not eject but actually commanded the seat to eject him from the aircraft, if he was actually happy that he didn't have to eject.
I would have mixed emotions. One, you got down okay, but B is that I'd be very weary of flying that with ejection seat that doesn't work. I don't know why it didn't go. The ACES seats have always been very, very reliable, so I hadn't heard about that one.
What provision was there on the SR-71 for was there an ejection seat in the SR-71?
Yes. Okay. It was built by Lockheed. It was good from Mach 3, Mach 3.1, 3.2, 3.3, up to 80,000 feet. It's been tested up to 100,000 feet. It starts off as a ballistic charge, so when you pull the D-ring between your legs, a lot of things happen. And the first thing that happens is that you have foot retractors, just like the 104 had, retracting to lock your legs in, because you obviously at Mach 3, you don't want your legs out, you'll lose them. So when you first pull on it, it's a ballistic charge for about 18 inches. So you go out on a big bang up the rails, and then it's got a lanyard attached to the bottom of the floor of the cockpit, and it, when it reaches that 18-inch extension, and then a rocket motor then ignites and then takes you up and clears the tail at Mach 3. So it was a two-stage kind of an ejection seat. Very reliable. Everyone has basically got out of it. Some of the test pilots, they drowned in the Pacific Ocean because of the pressure suit, but that's a whole other issue. But basically, everyone that has pulled the ejection handle on the SR has gotten out. And there were some that did pull it, but they didn't make it, obviously.
Yeah. If you had told me that the ejection seat was only usable up to a certain speed, I would have believed it. But you could operate that at Mach 3? That's
why the pressure suit. I mean, besides it provides its own environment. When you bail out it, when you pull the ejection handle at 80,000 or 75,000 feet, you are now in your own little cocoon with your own pressurization and oxygen and everything. So, and you stay in the seat. So once you eject, you stay in the seat. A little drogue chute, about a 4-foot drogue chute, is attached to the top of the seat. So as you come down, you're just sort of like riding like an elevator all the way down to 18,000 feet, where it then separates, and then you separate, and so on.
Sure, sure. All right. Well, if our conversation about ejection seats sounds a little familiar, that's because we talked about ejection seats back in episode 459. That was with Tony Gott, who's is from the ejection seat manufacturer Martin Baker. And so if you want to go back and sort of refresh your ejection seat tech, you can take a look at episode 459. All right, one more story. Brian, Thailand is they're restricting tourism. At the same time, they're planning to build some more airports, I guess.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting, for a few reasons. I mean, Thailand's a wonderful country to go to and vacation at, and certainly lots of wonderful things to see. It seems like there are certain areas that are suffering from a bit of overcrowding, and so they've shut down one area, but then a very popular tourist destination of Phuket, and another one. I don't think so much so a tourist destination, but still, there are a fair amount of tourists that go up north to Chiang Mai, but it's still a decent business center as well. Looks like they've run out of space and are building new airports. So not only is there a pilot shortage, but there's an airport shortage as well.
Yeah,
I just found it interesting that they were reallocating the resources.
Yeah. And when we, when we look at tourism and we look at the forecast for growth in the in terms of the number of pilots that are needed, in terms of the number of aircraft mechanics and things like that, I mean, a lot of that is driven by tourism. And this article in the Telegraph has got a really interesting chart that shows which areas are seeing the most travel growth. In terms of percentage increase since 2010. And the number one destination is Japan, 234% increase in travel since 2010.
Yeah, that one really surprised me.
Yeah, I if I had to guess, I would have guessed something else. India is number two, 191% increase. And then Vietnam, 158%. Thailand, there we go, 123% increase. Then we're over to the UAE, 116%, Philippines, 89%, then Greece, Croatia, Mexico, and Netherlands, at 64% increase. But there's a lot of growth in the Asia-Pacific region, of course, and that's where we see a lot of demand for pilots coming up. So interesting little chart. Again, we're speaking with Colonel Richard Graham. Rich, an SR-71 crew member, instructor pilot, wing commander, airline pilot, and author. Rich, you've got a number of books on the SR-71. I think five, is it?
The five books I've written on the SR all began in 1995. And ironically, each year it's worked out every 5 years I've done a book, up to five of them. And there's actually a sixth one out, which is the SR-71's flight manual. And what they asked me to do is put in 2,500 words for each section of the flight manual. So it's got some pictures and some words that define about the missions while you read the actual flight manual.
And there's a really good review by yours truly on the podcast about this, about a year. When did it come out?
That was about a year ago.
Yeah. We reviewed the book on, I got my review copy and toted around the very large tome that it is.
It is big.
We asked our listeners in our Slack team for what kinds of questions, what kinds of things that they were curious about the SR-71 or would like to know, things that hadn't been answered in the past. And we got some really interesting questions. We can maybe sort of combine a couple of them. When we look at spy planes, the SR-71, the U-2, and the use of satellites now. And Rich, maybe you can talk a little bit about the progression in terms of sort of the mission and the ability of the SR-71 to complete that mission, the U-2, and maybe what we have now with satellites. When you look at that sort of historical timeline, how do you break that up or characterize different sections of it?
The SR came out as a need, and that need was to be able to overfly the Soviet Union. Many of you, I'm sure your listeners know all about the U-2 and Gary Powers getting shot down on May 1st of 1960. Now, if you back it up 2 years to about 1958, Kelly was already working because he and many others realized that the Russians were getting much more aggressive in their attempts to shoot down the U-2. So Kelly started developing an airplane that was going to go higher and faster than the U-2. And it was designed for the CIA, called the A-12. So there were 12 iterations of what he called the Archangel program. That's why it was called the A-12, for Archangel number 12. And that was the predecessor to the SR-71, which is now flown by Air Force pilots. So the A-12, they flew 17 missions, I believe it was, out of Okinawa for a one-year period, and then immediately replaced with the SR-71s. The president got very nervous with the covert nature, with CIA guys flying the airplanes. He was much more comfortable with Air Force officers, Geneva Convention cards, and flying the same kind of missions. So we sort of took the mission over, doing the same things that the A-12s were doing. And the other version was called the YF-12. This is a time when the United States had this great, tremendous fear of the Russian bisons and bears coming down the Aleutian chain. And we didn't have any interceptors that had neither the speed nor the range to stop them. So they wanted to develop an interceptor version of the A-12, which came out to be the YF-12. And only three of those were built, but very successful, but it died for lack of funding. Hmm. And then the third one is the SR-71, which came out, and of that, 29 of those were built.
And then we see the U-2 seemed to have a longer operational lifespan than the SR-71. Is that correct? And why was that?
Yep. It's flying right now today. And in fact, I just watched a nice video on TV where someone went up in the airplane. Very well done, very documentary. Hmm. And it can stay up for a long time. It's a standoff platform. It obviously can't do overflights. It'll get shot down just as easy as Gary Powers got shot down. But its forte is being able to stand up long ranges from the battlefields and stay at 70,000 feet and supply a tremendous amount of intelligence to the ground stations. And it does a good job of it and at a very cheap rate. The SR-71 was very, very expensive.
Hmm. I've been taking a look recently. I think Brian showed us an article that talked about the refueling process of the SR-71 and how the aircraft were typically refueled shortly after taking off for some fairly interesting reasons.
Well, there's only one reason. There's one documentary, it's on TV, and I want to shoot this guy. He says that the SR-71 has to refuel right after takeoff because it leaks fuel so profusely. And I can't think of anything that's so far out there that is not even close to the answer. The real answer, it gets sort of convoluted, but if you sort of stay with me, I'll tell you why we refuel after takeoff. The fuel in the airplane, the JP7, which has a very high flash point, it's going to get eventually, it'll get up to about 350 to 375 degrees Fahrenheit, just from the skin temperature heating it up. So that'll be your end result. And you have fumes, as you burn down fuel, all those fumes are just stagnating above the tanks. You are looking for an explosion because the exterior of the airplane will get up around the 500 to 550 degrees, just the titanium. So between that and the fumes inside the tanks, you're looking for a major explosion. To preclude that from happening, up in the nose wheel well, we had three liquid nitrogen jewelers. So liquid nitrogen, three of them up there. They were plumbed back to gaseous nitrogen all the way to all six main fuel tanks with a head pressure of about 2 to 3 PSI. Now I will ask you, what is the only way to guarantee an inert atmosphere in those six tanks?
Yeah, you've got to force out the any air that's in there, right?
That's it. That's what we call refueling. So if you take off, you refuel the airplane, it goes all the way to the top, it squeezes out all the ambient air, and now the valves close, and from then on, every square inch as you burn down fuel is now going to be replaced with a 100% nitrogen atmosphere. That is why we refuel after takeoff.
So Rich, was the plane full at takeoff, though?
No, we could take off. We normally took off with a 55, 65, or 75,000-pound fuel load. Those were the normals, 55, 65, or 75,000. You could take off with an 80,000. Not good on tires. Takeoff performance is very marginal from about the time you get to gear up until you get up to about 180, 190 knots. Your single-engine capability gets very marginal in there. But, yes, you could take off with 80,000. But you want to make sure, the only way to really ensure that is, like we said, you take, and we had to hit a tanker anyhow, because you're going to consume so much fuel on a takeoff roll and getting to the target area. So we just get the forward base of the tankers, and they're real close to the target areas, and then we refuel, and then we have a lot more reserve.
We do hear about the issue of the SR-71 being leaky with the fuel. To what extent is that really the case?
It does. It leaks fuel, and there was no way to humanly seal every little square inch underneath the airplane where it was going to leak because of the shifting of the titanium and the tanks. And what happens is the crew chief for each airplane, once a month or some frequency, it was like once a month or every 6 weeks, he fills the airplane up with a full load of gas in the hangar. And then they have all the drips coming out of the airplane, and they watch it, and they have a stopwatch, and they start a stopwatch for every place it's dripping. And every location underneath the airplane had a maximum DPMs, drips per minute. So we had a chart. No, the base guys had this chart, a profile of the airplane underneath. In some locations, it was 10 drips per minute, and other locations, it was up to 60 to 80 drips per minute were tolerable. Once it exceeded any one of those drips per minute and any one of those locations, they had to get a little miniature guy go up and seal up all those tanks. So it was acceptable. There was a lot of JP4 on the ground. You could throw a match into it. You could throw a cigarette into it when the guys were used to be smoking, and it would just extinguish itself in the JP7.
Yeah, sure. We had a question from one of our listeners, Jonathan. And he wrote to say that he's experienced a compressor stall on an airliner, and he said it was fairly jarring. Jonathan says, so I have to wonder, what did it feel like to experience a not uncommon inlet unstart in the early SR-71s and A-12s?
Early days, that's where we lost a lot of the airplanes because of the unstarts. An unstart is it's an aerodynamic maneuver only. It has nothing to do with the engine. The engine keeps on running. The afterburner still keeps on cooking. It's expulsion of the shockwave that's being maintained inside that inlet. If it gets off just a little bit off of schedule, it'll go burp, and it shoots that shockwave out in front of the engine, and it pitches and rolls real violently towards that engine and pitches up and roll. And we lost some airplanes in early days because they were just learning what these unstarts were all about. The engine doesn't quit, so it has nothing to do with the engine. It's all aerodynamic with the air going through that inlet.
Interesting. The whole engine operation, of course, to me is fairly fascinating. I guess it was fairly unique for that period of time.
Very, very new. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit maybe about how you came to move from flying the F-4s and got involved in the SR-71 program. How did that come about?
After I got out of Vietnam and the Wild Weasels, my assignment was to Okinawa, Japan. That's where the Wild Weasels were. And as I sat there and flew the F-4s around the skies, I kept seeing that special airplane having all this nice... You had to clear the runway. They had the runway to themselves, and we had to sit there and watch them. And I saw them. I said, you know, it's time for a change of airplanes. And I've seen a thrive on that kind of a airplane. So I put my package in. Everyone applies to the program. You send this package with all your flying evaluations, all your OERs, all your efficiency reports, recommendations from your commanders. This whole package goes to Beale Air Force Base in California. And about twice a year, all the crew members, the squadron commander, the ops officer, the DO, the wing commander, they all sit around this table and they pass each folder around. And on the front cover of the folder has yes or no. And each person has a chance to put, after reading the records, they can put a no on it. Anyone that made around that whole table with the yeses, he got invited out for their interview. Now you go back to Beale. I got on one of their tankers from Okinawa and went to Beale. And for the first 2 days, you do nothing but one-on-one interviews with everyone from the wing commander down to the squadron crew members and the squadron commander. And they all have a say on the yes or no. The next 2 days, you get evaluated. You get two flights in the T-38 to check your flying skills. And also, you get one ride in the SR-71 simulator just to see how you adapt to a whole new environment. They don't expect you to do miracles with it, but they want to see how you adapt. The next 2 days of your week's interview is down at Travis Air Force Base where you take your physical. It's not as demanding as the astronaut physical, but it's a lot more than the normal Air Force physical, about halfway in between and what they're checking for. That's your whole week. And then I go back to Okinawa. I keep flying my F-4. And about 2 months later, you'll either get a letter of acceptance or a letter of rejection. And I was very lucky to get a letter of acceptance. And my reporting was 6 months later at Beale Air Force Base in 1974.
Did you have any clue that you were going to be accepted, or was it just...
No. They all say, you did good on the flying. You did good. You talk to all the guys. They all say, you're great. We love to have you aboard, but you don't know. You never know for sure. And then once I became part of the process, I understood. They were very friendly, and that's the way you are. But you don't spill the beans because no one's person knows the answer until we put it all together. And that's why it takes 2 months to get a letter of either acceptance or rejection.
And then the process, once you were accepted, before you started flying regularly, was that a lot of simulator time?
Yes. And this is where you're going to either fail. We try to wash out the pilots or the navigators well before they get deep into the money part of it and actually flying the airplane. So the simulator is 12 missions, okay, 1 through 12. And each one of those numbered missions, 1 through 12, has two practice rides. So you get two practice rides for mission number one, where you're working on emergencies and just flying the airplane and handling characteristics. Each one gets more involved. So you take your two practice rides, and then you take a check ride. pass fail. You fail it, you go back to where you came from. I would have gone back to Air Force in Okinawa. If you pass it, you go on to mission number two. You get two practice rides. You pass number two, you go on to number three, or you fail. And so we try to wash the crew members out and see how they're going to do as a crew together and react well before they get to the airplane, the expensive part. And like I said, anyone at wash out of a program, you go right back to where you came from. For many, many years, the Air Force has what they call FEB boards, flying evaluation boards. If you wash out of a F-15 school or an F-16 school or a F-22 school, they're going to look at you and say, hey, why did this guy wash out? What's happened here? Maybe you shouldn't be flying single-seater. Maybe it'll be tankers or cargo airplanes. So you will meet an FEB that makes a decision on what your flying career is going to be. For all these years in the SR program, it was a recurring thing. About every 3 to 4 years, someone would come down from the Pentagon and say, hey, we want you guys to be part of our school catalog. And we said, you don't really want to do this because our washout rate was pretty good. These are good pilots. They've got good credentials. They're just not meant for the SR-71. And we avoided that for all those years because the Air Force doesn't like to have this little separate school that can do this.
So how much faster were your reaction times? One of the things that you mentioned in your book is you have to think faster than, say, you're flying in a Phantom. It's a difference between going several hundred miles and several thousand miles in the same amount of time. Add to that, you're in a pressure suit. What's that like compared to flying, say, a Phantom? That whole faster, but in a suit that's kind of limiting.
It is more cumbersome, obviously, being in a pressure suit. Once you get in the seat in the cockpit, it's not very roomy. It's pretty tight quarters from the left to right shoulders. To the up forward of the instrument panel and the stick, that was pretty roomy. But just left and right, a little bit claustrophobic for some people. I find the airplane very easy. It's a different animal. You have to treat it differently. You can't hot dog this thing. It's not a fighter. You have to baby it. Once it gets hot, you can bend metal real easy on a hot airplane. The temperature just gets up to. So it's basically a platform up there. And even though the temperatures at 70 and 80,000 feet are constantly a minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit outside, that airplane, the leading edges are going to get about 400, 450 degrees Fahrenheit in that minus 70 degree atmosphere. But in the cockpit, you can control the temperature. So the confinement of a pressure suit, I don't know of anyone that really didn't adapt to that very well. You know, I think some people may have got a little claustrophobic, but not to the point that ever affected their flying.
When you were flying, how busy were you? I mean, did you have time to contemplate the fact that you were zipping along at Mach 3 or look down at the clouds beneath you? Or were you pretty busy the whole time?
It was a busy cockpit. Busy cockpit. A lot of challenging checklists. The one nice thing about it is, and most people you can't really appreciate, once you get above 60,000 feet, we own all the airspace on the globe. There's no one else up there. We don't talk to anybody. We worked out radio silent procedures in both Mildenhall and Okinawa where we could take off, not talk to anyone, fly halfway around the globe, refuel 4 to 5 to 6 times, come back to Okinawa or Mildenhall, and that whole time you never, ever talked to anyone outside the airplane. So we had these radio silent procedures developed back in about 1977. We were told by the spooks that the bad guys were listening to everything we say when we talk over the radios, and they recommended that the National Security Agency recommended we develop radio silent procedures, which it took about 6-7 months to get all the tower people, all the RAPCON people, all the radar people just realize that we're not talking to you.
Did you ever encounter any, well, anxious moments, let's say?
The biggest one, my backseater, Dawn, we had, and I need to talk about Dawn. That's my backseater. You know, when you meet up with when I arrived in June of 74 at Beale Air Force Base to start my training, Dawn Emmons showed up in June of 1974. He was my backseater, my navigator. For the next 7 years, Dawn Emmons is the only guy I could fly the airplane with. and I'm the only pilot that he can fly with. We do not ever, ever mix and match crew members. Huh. So he's the only person I flew with. And it's very important. Not like flying an F-4 where you don't, it doesn't matter that much who's in your back seat for the day. But in the SR, it is important you know each other intimately. So Don and I were flying a mission that goes, you know where the Kamchatka Peninsula is? Hmm. It's a part, it belongs to Russia. At the very southern end of the Kamchatka Peninsula is a place called Petropavlovsk. And we call it Petro for short. To most of your readers, if you just take the Aleutian chain from Alaska, go out to Adak, and that chain keeps on going over towards Russia, and that's where the Kamchatka Peninsula is. And we would go up and image that probably once every month, maybe twice a month. We'd go up over Japan, take off at Okinawa, refuel over Japan, climb back up, cruise up there, be about 75,000, 77,000 feet. By the time we went a beam of the Petropavlovsk and would image it off to the left and would do a 90-degree turn to the right, 270 back to the left, and image it coming back on the left-hand side. And then on the way back down to Okinawa. On the way up, this was a perfect storm. Doesn't always happen. I had clear skies. I could see this blue water. And the visibility was just about unrestricted. And from 75, 80,000 feet, you can see a long ways. And I happened to notice about when we were getting close to the sensitive area, you know, once you get into what we call the sensitive area, we go through a whole checklist and different things happen in the cockpit. I could see these contrails up ahead. And I looked at them as we got closer, and I could actually break them out. I saw three contrails in a circle. They were in a clockwise circle. And as I got closer, I saw them coming out of the circle. I've already been talking to Don over this, and we were ready for it. They came out of the circle, and they were in trail now, probably about a 15-mile trail, just roughly what they looked like, still contrailing. And then I saw the contrail stop, so I knew they were just stroking the burners and starting to come up. And as they came up, I told Don, he has the ability in the back seat to take what we call happy snaps. He can push a button and take pictures of just what's directly beneath you, basically. And so he got his view sight on, and he says, there goes number one, snap. There goes number two, snap. And number three, he took a picture of it. And you can see on the photographs afterward, these MiGs just falling out of the sky, just like a leaf coming down. Now, they never fired at us. Never, nothing was ever said, but they were trying to come up and get us. That was what the intel said.
Yeah, you were on top of the world.
And ironically, my good friend, Viktor Belenko, is up at Oshkosh every year. If you remember, he's the one that defected from Russia into Japan with the MiG-25. Hmm. And he still shows up every year at Oshkosh, and he and I go out and have a beer and reminisce.
Oh, isn't that something? That's great.
Yeah, it is.
That's great.
Now, it didn't happen to be him that day, he said, but he was flying the MiG-25s.
Well, we mentioned earlier that the SR-71, the whole program was conducted in a different era. Of course, we still have the Skunk Works, and the Skunk Works is still doing very interesting things. But I think today's Skunk Works is different than that of years past. Is it even conceivable that an aircraft of these kinds of capabilities could be designed today? What do you think, Rich?
I don't know. I have my mixed emotions about it. You know, I was very fortunate in my time frame. I got to meet Kelly Johnson. He would come up the Beetle. The Pinion, give you your Mach 3 pin when you go for the first time to go Mach 3. And I thought the world of him. Everyone I know that worked for him, they called him a taskmaster, but he gave you all the authority and all the money to do it and make it happen. And I can't say enough about just being very honored to know Kelly and all the airplanes he's done, particularly the SR-71, obviously.
Do you think that all of these accomplishments of the Skunk Works are because of Kelly? If there had not been that man, that we would not have many of the things that ended up coming out of the Skunk Works?
I agree with that comment 100%. The F-117, he did the 104, the U-2. Kelly was a genius, and I think if it weren't for him, I'm not sure that drive and that special Skunk Works mentality would be there today without him around, starting it out.
Yeah, that's interesting, because a lot of times especially these days, I think there's a lot of emphasis placed on the team, in a team effort. And, of course, that can be very, very valuable. You bring a group of people that have a lot of diversity of ideas and thinking styles together, and you come up with some really creative things. But sometimes there's still a role for that one individual that can be a visionary in a way that a team couldn't be. And it sounds like that was the way you might describe Kelly.
That's exactly how I describe him. Yeah. One of a kind.
Yeah.
So, Rich, I was just wondering, going from the SR-71 to then flying the MD-80, which I believe is maybe not so technologically advanced, what was that like, not only from the speed standpoint, but again, the technology?
I can't say I found it ho-hum flying for the airlines. It was a great job. I was lucky to do it for my 13 years and I hit the magic 60. It's a different kind of flying, and you just have to change your mindset. Now, you got to realize, when I came aboard with American Airlines, they weren't hiring pilots. They were only hiring flight engineers. So I had to go down and get my quickie down at Long Beach, California, my flight engineer's license, along with other guys that wanted to apply. And when I hired on, that's what the school was. It was a flight engineer. It was run by the professional two-stripers. It's the worst and hardest school I've ever been to in my life, ever. Because these two stripers they said, we're going to make you pilots learn every nut and bolt and rivet on this darn airplane. And that's it was a rite of passage. It really was. I know a lot of guys in the military, some colonels, they were doing it to the same school I was. I'd meet them there for lunch, and they were friends of mine. They just walked out the door. They said, I can't handle this. You know, the mentality that, it's an attitude. You have to have you got to see the long range goals of doing this, which is what I saw. And you just have to stick it out. And I saw some guys just said, nope, I can't do this.
Yeah, that was actually the second question I had for you as a follow up, is going from being a pilot to being a flight engineer, just mentally, what did that do to you? And was it an easy transition for you? And it sounds like it took some mental fortitude for you to get through that.
It did, but everyone has a different attitude about life. And I just said, get through this, being flight engineer. They tell you about just look at seniority list, how long you're going to be on. I knew I'd only going to be an engineer for 2 years. And I said, hang in there. The money's good. The perks are good. Get free flying for the rest of your life kind of thing. So my attitude was, okay, this is long range. And other guys it was basically too belittling for them to be a flight engineer. They come out of the Air Force with, decorations and, F-4s and SRs. And we had a couple SR guys that they called it quits. They just couldn't handle it mentally.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's different.
Sure.
And now it kind of seems like going full circle. You're teaching these days. I really wish that more commercial pilots would get into teaching, especially once they reach the magical age where they can no longer fly for the airlines, since we do seem to have a shortage of instructors. And so I was just wondering how you're enjoying teaching, and the quantity of students you're going through, the type of students, anything that you could tell us about what it's like being a teacher these days.
Well, I got my license when I was 17 years old. My dad was a Navy Corsair pilot. And he taught both my brother and I how to fly at a little airport in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. And then I said, I had no way of earning money, but what I did, I worked at the airport on my summers, cutting grass, pumping gas, putting oil in airplanes, helping the mechanic, doing all these odd jobs. And instead of getting paid, I got flying hours. And my dad was free. He was already had the instructor license. So my dad taught both my brother and I how to fly at an early age. And so I love going back to my grassroots now and flying these back to the 172s and, few retractables and teaching guys how to fly. And watching them solo out is something you just, when I hop out of the airplane, go up in the tower and I got binoculars on them, you just feel really great that they did it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, what kind of aircraft are you instructing in?
We got the club has 4 172s. We got a Piper Arrow, which is retractable, and we just picked up an Archer. It's the only one with air conditioning, so everyone wants to fly the air conditioning.
Yeah, I bet. All right. Well, that's wonderful. Rich, we really want to thank you for coming on the Airplane Geeks podcast. I know your books are available on Amazon. That's where I generally see them.
Yes, they're on Amazon. But if your listeners want to get an autographed copy, me, you go on eBay and my seller's ID. You have to make sure it's me because everyone else is selling books. If you want my autograph,
yeah,
the seller's ID is SR-71 Pilot. 1974-1981. That is me selling my books.
Oh, cool. Okay, and we'll put that in the show notes. So if you're listening to this and you didn't capture that quickly enough, just visit airplanegeeks.com/507, and along with all the other information from this episode, you'll have that as well. So great. All right, Rich, thank you so much. Thank you for your service. Thank you for having an exciting life that probably many of us would love to have experienced ourselves. So we'll continue to live vicariously through you and through your books.
Thank you very much. I've been blessed in all my aviation, and I thoroughly enjoy it. Thank you.
All right, good.
And Rich, any interest in writing a book on your adventures in the commercial space, or you're going to stick to military writing?
Military, yeah. The commercial is too short, 13 years. I can't see a theme going here with that. I never had anything major happen to me or anything like that. So, no.
So the age of all the fun stories had kind of passed by the time that you started flying for the...
Oh, no. I got some fun stories.
I just can't put it in writing.
Here you go. Can't put it in writing.
Fair enough.
All right. Now we have a positive airline story of the week. Brian, what have you got for us this time?
Yeah, this comes to us from the Globe and Mail, and it's a story that talks about airline passenger satisfaction and how they've seen an increase in it. And I find, getting to experience a miracle flight is just amazing to me. The fact that I could go across the country in a few hours and any place in the globe in less than 24 hours is really amazing to me. And it's nice to see that customers, for the most part, are happy as well that they're able to do this. And J.D. Powers did this survey, although there is a quote in here that I might take exception with part of it. They say passengers perceive greater value in ticket prices. Checking has never been easier. Passengers are more satisfied with actual aircraft, and airlines have improved their baggage handling performance. And I don't know, maybe that might be true in general, but I think we could probably pick apart each one of those segments, and we probably all have our individual war stories on where the airlines haven't quite measured up. But I thought that this was really good, seeing that, at least according to J.D. Powers, North Americans are happy with the product that they're getting.
And I see this is a trend that's actually been taking place for a number of years.
Yes, seven.
Yeah, 7 years increased in this measurement. I'm kind of surprised, but I'm happy to hear it.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was, good on the entire industry. I know I tend to bash certain airlines and airlines in general over not providing a great superior product, but all in all, customers seem to be happy and continuing to be happy. And again, as much of the negativity as I talk about when I have things not quite go right, I still really am amazed that this whole system works and am so privileged to be able to fly.
All right. A little what's up with the geeks. Maybe I'll kick it off this time. We have a new episode of the PaxX podcast. This is episode 58. And Mary Kirby and I spoke with journalist Harriet Baskus, and we had an interesting conversation, particularly, I think, about this Air Transport Association annual general meeting that just took place in Sydney. This is the event where the Qatar Airways chief, and who happens to also be now appointed the IATA chair, Akbar Al Baker, he suggested that the job of an airline CEO could only be held by a man. And that's caused a lot of consternation.
Really? I can't imagine.
Yes, yes. Well, well, Harriet Baskis was there when he said it. So we talked to her about that. We also talked about the fact that the TSA continues to collect large and increasing numbers of firearms at security checkpoints. We talked about that. And then Harriet runs a really nice blog, and she had a lot to say about the things that airports are doing now to help you pass the time that you spend in airports. And a lot of them are doing some pretty interesting and creative things. So all that's in PaxX Podcast Episode 58. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Let's see. Brian, anything going on aviation-wise with you?
Yeah, I haven't been flying as much recently as I have in the past few years. So what I've been doing is watching a bunch of TV on aviation so I could get my fix. And coincidentally, I found a story in the Point Sky, and it was five must-see aviation documentaries on Netflix and Amazon. And some of these are also available on YouTube as well. And I found it really, really interesting that four of the five we have actually covered on the show.
Huh.
So, yeah, so the first one starts off with Brian Terwilliger's movie, One Six Right. So about the story about the Van Nuys Airport.
Yes.
The other one was, and we had Brian on episode 427. Then they talked about City in the Sky, and that's a PBS show. And we talked about that on episode 482. And then there was Flying the Feathered Edge, and we talked about that on episode 240.
Wow.
And then they mentioned the ICE pilots, and we had Mickey McBrien from Buffalo Airways on episode 146.
That's right.
So, yeah, so really the only thing that we didn't cover was the story about Airbus and Boeing, and it's called The Jumbo Race. And I actually thought that it was going to be a documentary about the 747 and A380. And it wasn't. It was really a story about the two companies and how they compete against each other. So the jumbo referring to the jumbo of the two organizations as opposed to jumbo aircraft. And if anyone, if people haven't seen Airbus Boeing, The Jumbo Race, highly recommend watching that as well. So there's a lot of good TV to watch to get your airplane fix.
All right, good. We'll have a link to that article in the show notes for sure. All right, we have some recordings from our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari. A couple of really short ones. Now, Launchpad was at the Texas Aircraft Expo. That's at texasaircraftexpo.com, which is pretty much a GA show, I guess. So we've got two short interviews, and let's start off with the first one. Stick around for the second one because he talks with a 12-year-old. So let's start off first, though, taking a look at what this event was all about.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, and I'm here with
Patrick Rozewski with CTL Aero Solutions.
And we're down here at an air show, but this is really kind of a different air show. There's no smoke oil in the air. There's no deep-fried Oreos. What are we doing here?
Well, Launchpad, we're not your typical air show. We're the Texas Aircraft Expo. We're a venue for aircraft brokers and sales companies, OEM distributors, and finance tax experts to come out and educate today's enthusiasts and buyers on what's new and current in the marketplace today.
Got it. So you're the vendor portion of what we see like at Oshkosh.
Yeah, we sometimes talk about a miniature Oshkosh or a miniature Sun and Fun, or people in Texas that can't make the trip can come out to some of the bigger cities in Texas and make that trip and learn a little bit more about what's available to them.
All right. And we've got at least 10 aircraft vendors out on the ramp, right?
Yeah, we've got, I think there's 15 airplanes out on this visit. Anything from a Waco to the Honda Jet is here this year, a Caravan, Kodiak is here. Of course, several Cirrus and TBM, Cutter Aviation is here with all their models. So we're glad to have everybody here.
And as you said, there's also insurance companies and other aircraft necessities.
We've got Advocate Tax Consulting, and we have Airfleet Capital here. They're two of our preferred providers for those needs in aviation.
All right. And is this just a one-site show?
We actually do this once or twice a year, and our typical cities are Dallas, Houston, and Austin. Sometimes we branch out into San Antonio or even out into West Texas, Midland, Lubbock areas. It just depends on the weather sometimes.
But it's not one show a year. You do like 3-4 stops in a season, right?
Correct. So today we're in Austin at Austin Executive Airport, and this is our third show of the spring series. So we were at Houston a couple weeks ago and then in Dallas Addison Airport back in April.
Okay, so to recap, this is an air show. If I want to come out and kick the tires and look at new airplanes and with that new car smell on the inside, ooh, this is where I'd go.
Correct. Yeah, we like to create a low pressure environment for people to come and see, potentially buy, without the one on one with, you know, the quote unquote sales pitch. It's come in, check it out, walk around, ask questions, and if you have more of an interest, they can arrange for demo flights and set up an interview for you down the road.
And if they wanted to know more and see your schedule, where would they go?
Our website is www.texasaircraftexpo.com.
Something to do on your weekend, a little bit different than the normal upside-down air show. This is Launchpad Marzari, your reporter at large. Frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Next, Launchpad talked with Claire. Claire is 12 years old, and she came to the event with her sister and father. It was sort of a father-daughter's day out, I think. So here's Launchpad and Claire.
Hello, airplane geeks. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. We're down here at the Texas Air Expo, and we've run into
Claire Mushka.
And Claire, how old are you?
I'm 12 years old.
What did you see here at the Texas? What brought you to the Texas Air Expo today?
My lonely dad.
Very nice. Got to keep dad company. Father-daughter thing. Okay, what's the coolest airplane you saw out there?
Probably the Honda Jet.
What's cool about that?
It has reclinable seats. It has its own bathroom in the back. And, yeah, the seats are really comfortable, and there's a lot of room, and there's really fancy tables in there, too.
And there's phone chargers.
And there's phone chargers. Hey, there's probably cup holders, too. So what were your overall impressions of all the airplanes here?
It was pretty cool to be up close to these airplanes, because my dad would send me pictures of him, like, flying one, and this is like my first time getting up close to an actual airplane that the types of airplanes that he flies.
And what else did you get to learn about while you were here?
Oh, Oshkosh.
Oh, Oshkosh, Air Venture. And what else did we learn about while we were here?
Women in aviation.
Ah, very good. So you're possibly thinking about a career in aviation?
Yes.
Let me interrupt with a page from the reporter's notebook. We ran into Claire at the show. She was overwhelmed with the fact that she got to touch and sit in the airplanes. She learned about women in aviation and potential scholarships. AOPA's Aviators, spelled Alpha Victor 8 Romeo Sierra, for kids her age. But what really captured her and why she wants to go to Oshkosh is the one-week wonder. She was totally impressed with the idea that she could pull a rivet, bend some sheet metal, and then got to sign the builder's logbook, an official document. In her words, "I get to build an airplane?" Yes, you do. The point of this is that you can inspire the next generation of aviators yourself. Back to the report. And you're going to get to go to Oshkosh maybe this year?
Hopefully.
Well, that's wonderful, Claire. And thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This is Launchpad Marzari, your reporter at large. Frequency change approved. Good day.
I think that's really cool. I really enjoyed listening to Claire. And I think it is a great example of how something as simple as, you know, bringing young people to an aviation event can really spark their interest.
And I'd really love to see Claire grow up and prove Mr. Albaker wrong.
Yes. All right.
Have her take control of an airline. And that comment just really got to me.
Yes. Launchpad also sent along a number of links that we'll have in the show notes, things like the Women in Aviation International Scholarships page, the AOPA Aviators, How to Build a Plane in 7 Days at EAA Air Venture, One-Week Wonder Time Lapse. This is a really fascinating look at time lapse of the One-Week Wonder, and also a video from WestJet. They're saluting women in aviation. So we'll have all those links in the show notes. All right. Oh, only a few minutes before we started recording, we received a message from our main man, Micah, and he's got a little recording. We haven't listened to it, so you're hearing it for the first time, just like us.
Hey, everyone. Just a little off-the-cuff note here. I just finished listening to the latest Airplane Geeks. It was wonderful, as always, episode 506 with Erica Armstrong in the cockpit. Anyway, in listening to that, I heard Jason's email to us. And, you know, it reminded me of a wonderful story. A story that Brian wrote, his story, his introduction into aircraft, and how he became an airplane geek. That appeared on episode 269, Upset Prevention and Recovery Training, and that I was honored enough to be asked to narrate for him. Now, maybe Jason would like to go back and listen to that, but really, it's been a long time, and I think it would be wonderful if maybe Brian would be able to maybe redo that story for us, or bring it up himself. It's a story that introduced us to Brian. It's a story that made Brian and I as good of friends as we are. And it would be wonderful to hear it again in his own voice. Just a quick thought, and maybe we can have that happen someday. Have a great day, everyone. For the Airplane Geeks, here in Portland, Maine, this is your main man, Micah.
I remember that. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was a very, very long time ago. And I remember I was sick as can be and ended up asking you to ask Micah to record that. I don't think I could do half as good a job as Micah did. So I don't know.
We'll have to go back and re-listen to that again. Yeah. I got to refresh my memory. See if it needs maybe a refresh from you, but,
Yeah, I don't know. If the listeners want me to do it, this is a surprise to me. I had no idea that Micah dreamt this one up. But I don't think I could do any better than he did. So I don't see any need in doing this. But we'll see.
And a nice thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've got to go back and re-listen to that. All right. Some other listener mail really quickly before we finish up here. That David wrote us, he said in episode 506, you read a message from Arnie, who noted that he hadn't pursued flight training because of some color blindness. Now, he says, I heard this misconception from others in the past. For night or instrument flying, and hence most commercial work, you need to be able to differentiate colors. But in most countries, it is possible to do some form of VFR flying even with color blindness. David writes, I'm neither based in Norway, which is where Arnie was from, if you recall, nor a flying instructor, nor colorblind, but I'd like to share with other listeners how much hobby flying you can do without an AME medical. For example, I've flown a UK Microlite through France, Belgium, Netherlands, Denmark, and Spain on a medical declaration based on a driving license. I haven't made it to Norway yet, but it is on my list. So if you thought flying wasn't possible, then think again. You may be limited to VFR flying in smaller aircraft, but then most hobby pilots prefer to look out the window at the view anyway. And that's from David. Thank you, David. And then Albert wrote in. This is from Holland, actually, also. He says, I recently found your fantastic podcast, and I'm catching up on the older ones, so I have some listening to do. Yeah, we do have a pretty big back catalog. He says, in episode 497, I found two extra interesting stories, one concerning the Lockheed Starliner and one about a museum abandoning electronic information gadgets. He says, I am one of the 250 volunteers of the Dutch Air and Space Museum, Aviodrome. The news that I want to share with you is that we, just like our German friends, will soon get a new plane in our museum, a Convair 340. It is currently in South Africa, and it will be restored to flight status there, and it will fly in about 10 legs to Lelystad Airport, where our museum is. The plane is a gift from Robos Rail in South Africa that used the plane over there. Still, it takes a lot of money to get it to the Netherlands. Our museum does not have the resources and the backing like the American museums seem to have, so we are very pleased that this way we could expand our collection with this iconic plane that served KLM and Martin Air so well. And he says the plane is due to arrive July 22nd. Their website is aviodrome.nl. That's aviodrome.nl. He says the Aviodrome has a great collection of planes and motors, which includes a lot of historic original Fokker planes and lots of other interesting objects like a Constellation and an airworthy DC-2. The other thing that struck me in that episode was a thing that someone from an air museum said about digital presentations. Quote, we can't compete with kids with an iPad. Well, he says our museum takes the same approach. It is the task of the volunteer and stewards to bring the museum to life, and we love to do just that. Therefore, we have 4 guided tours a day, and we do English-spoken tours on demand. It was nice to hear that other museums have that same attitude and don't rely on digital gadgets to explain the history of aviation. And finally, Albert says, keep on doing the good work with your podcast. And if you want more information, be glad to send it, he says. And if one of us ever comes to Holland, mail him and you'll be the guest of honor, he says, Albert. So thank you for that. Thanks for the update on the new aircraft coming to the museum. Hope that goes well. Boy, you know, I used to travel to the Netherlands, to Brussels, and to visit the Sabena facility. These are all business trips, of course. And then we had an operation in Maastricht in the Netherlands, and then I'd head up to Amsterdam, where I had a warehouse up there, a parts warehouse for aircraft engines. Beautiful country. It's been a number of years. So, yeah, if I'm ever up there, Albert, or over there, I guess you'd say, we'll definitely look you up. And thanks for the email. All right. With that, that brings this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast to a close. I want to thank all of you for listening, and we want to thank our guest, Colonel Richard Graham, SR-71 flyer, instructor, author, just a wonderful career. Probably could have spoken to him for hours and hours. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/506. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us.
Or 507, since that's
what episode show. This is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoops. Okay, 507. airplanegeeks.com/507. Thank you, Brian. Brian, while you're at it, tell us where listeners can contact you.
People can get a hold of me at brian@airplanegeeks.com. And if they want to be like the other listener, go back and be a completist and listen to all of the episodes, they can go to airplanegeeks.com/archive. And by year, we have all of the episodes cataloged, and you can download them by year.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, where do we find you online?
If you want to find me, you can find the three of us this Saturday, as we record this, June 16th, 2018, at the Udvar Hazy Center for Innovations of Flight 18. We're expecting to see Aunt Binet and Micah and some of our friends from the Airline Pilot Guide group. So if you're in the D.C. area, we always say come out and see us. We'll be going out to Red Robin for dinner to have adult beverages and the swap stories, and we always have a good time. But if you can't make it, you can always find me online at DM Vanderhoof on Twitter. And, of course, on Friday mornings with that guy Max Flight talking about drones on the UAVDigest.com.
And, David, what's the hashtag for the event?
InFlight18.
Very good.
And I'm kind of partial to that hashtag.
Well, you came up with that hashtag, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
All right.
And Max, I guess no one wants to teach me how to use Slack because I didn't get any emails this past week of people volunteering. So I guess I'm just going to stay antisocial.
No. We'll have a remedial Slack training at the Air and Space Museum.
There you go.
I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and also with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. But most of all, on the Slack listener team. That's where I really hang out the most, I think. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. Find him at BrunoMassone.com. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up, and thanks for listening. It actually has side rails, or basically armrests, because of the long endurance missions. So it's a slightly different seat than you would see. No, I'm here, aren't I?
I can't. Sounds
like we lost him.
I can't hear David.
I'm here.
I guess he ejected.
Better.
Oh, that's good. David, are you there? We see you. I can
check.
Okay, you're back.
He's back.
I've been here the whole time.
Did you get the point where we lost you?
Yeah, but
we lost him again.
Seems to have recurred.
Better.
Yep.
Okay. Rich, write your shooter stories, please. Forget the boring SR-71. I want to hear about shooter stories.
Jeez, shooters.
YGBSM.
You got to be shitting me.
That's the ones I want to hear about. I want to hear about the weasel stories.
Well, that was the weasel that I flew. Yeah, F4. And that was it. That was our motto, YGBSM. You know how that evolved, don't you?
Yeah, because they eventually, somebody realized that your job was to get shot at so you can shoot him back.
It was a young lieutenant. You got time for this?
Yeah, sure.
It was a young lieutenant coming out of he was an EWO, coming out of B-52s, and he thought about being a wild weasel pilot. He didn't hear much about it. He just knew it was a nice job, and it's right up his alley. It was, you know, signals and ELINT and all that. So he went to the squadron commander of the wild weasel, and he said, "Sir, I'd like to be a wild weasel pilot. Can you tell me a little bit about it?" And the squadron commander laid it on, and this guy just, from what I've heard, his eyes were just getting bigger and bigger. And he drops his mouth, and the colonel gets done talking to him about it. And he turns around and he says, "You got to be shitting me. You want me to do what? You want me to fly in this airplane with an egotistical fighter pilot inside the SAM's range? It could go faster than you can go at it with a missile." Said, "I'm out of here." He sold the Sergeant Commander. You got to be shitting me.
So you were in D's and G's. Did you get up to the G's or
No, I didn't get the G's. We did the Wild Weasels were the C models. I did the D models first at Udorn for a year in a triple nickel. And then my assignment of that year was to Okinawa into the Wild Weasel Squadron, and that brought me back to Karat with the Wild Weasels, where we flew along with the 105 Weasels.
Ah, so you were in Weasel 1s, Phantoms. Cool.
Well, no, Weasel 1 was the F-100. That was the first airplane, F-100, then the 105 and the F-4. And then the F-4Gs became the result of Vietnam, the lessons learned that we need a dedicated airplane, the G model. It's a good mission, though. I like the Wild Weasel mission, especially during those 11 days of Christmas. So it was good up there. The sad part about it is we could have done that years before. Could have had that thing over with in 11 days.
Sorry, I didn't mean to divert them.
That's okay.
Well, yeah, I did, because...
Yeah, you did. You did exactly what you wanted to do.
And David, this is why I wanted to get him on the show for you.
Yeah,
I could care less about the SR-71. Let's talk about real airplanes.
Oh, come on.
That shoot back.
And David Vanderhoof, where do we find you online?
Well, if you want to find me in person... I'm off mute.
Unless it was call dropped again.
No, it... Oh. Okay, here's a little story. Everybody hates me now on conference calls in the office because I'm always on mute. That's my life in life. My lot in life is I'm always on mute.
That could be an episode title, you know, for one of these episodes. David on mute.
Come off mute and talk to us.
Well, or more to the point, if you want to find me...